One of the most prominent commemorative structures in the United States is the Washington Monument, built to honor one of the greatest men in American history, and standing as the tallest building in Washington, D.C. This unusual obelisk is filled with secrets and mystery, and today we'll unveil them all. So join me in discovering the history of the Washington Monument. I'm your host, Ryan Sokash, and you're watching It's History. Before looking at the Washington Monument as a structure, it's important to understand why it was built and why we honor George Washington as a president, general, statesman, and person. While the Washington Monument is most likely the first to come to mind, it is far from the only structure built in the former president's name or character. Believe it or not, there is actually an older Washington Monument in Maryland built all the way back in 1827. Then, 2 years later, another one was built in Baltimore. Aside from these singular structures, there are numerous streets, lakes, schools, mountains, ships, a federal holiday, and even other famous Americans in honor of George Washington. Not to mention the actual state of Washington, the 42nd state in the Union. And then, of course, there's the capital of the entire country, Washington, D.C., where the Washington Monument is located. But who's the man behind the name? George Washington is arguably the most widely recognized and iconic figure in American history. As was said before, he's regarded by most as the father of the United States, as well as America's greatest president. So with that in mind, let's take a moment to explore a little bit of his story for context. George Washington was born in the Virginia colony on February the 22nd, 1732, and very quickly in his early life, he ascended to prominence with the British Army, where he acquired the skills to conquer formidable challenges and master the art of leadership, gaining the reputation of a skilled tactician and military leader. Following his service in the British military, Washington transitioned into civilian life, where he became a prosperous statesman and landowner while also starting his own family. However, he would eventually re-enter military service, this time on the side of the American patriots on the eve of the Revolution. Once the Continental Army was assembled, Washington was nominated for the role of Commander-in-Chief due to his military record, leadership skills, as well as his support for the cause. He was then unanimously elected by the Continental Congress. As the Revolutionary War unfolded, Washington was confronted with numerous difficulties and obstacles in his way, such as harsh weather conditions, dwindling numbers of troops, lack of supplies, and the gargantuan task of going up against the strongest military force in the world at the time, the British military. However, his ingenious and clever tactics ultimately steered the colonies towards victory, ensuring their freedom from British rule. After the war concluded, the U.S. secured independence. Washington could have used the momentum of his military triumph to retain power as a military dictator, yet he chose to step down, allowing the Continental Congress to take charge of constructing the new nation on their own. Nonetheless, after the Constitution was adopted, Congress unanimously chose Washington as the inaugural president of the United States of America in 1788, recognizing that there was no one more qualified to guide the nation. Washington then established the precedent for what it meant to be the executive of the United States. In doing so, he played a pivotal role in solidifying the core values and principles that this nation has upheld. Despite not aligning with any political party and even cautioning against their formation, Washington's personal Federalist beliefs played a crucial role in transforming the United States from a loosely organized confederation of 13 autonomous states into a strong and unified nation. He accomplished this by promoting nationwide trade and commerce, strengthening national cohesion to maintain the Union, and safeguarding American borders. In the end, he built a Federalist legacy that would endure throughout the subsequent administration led by John Adams. What is possibly more important, though, is what Washington did not do For instance, he wisely understood the precarious state of the new nation and refrained from entangling the United States in foreign affairs that might have led to a crippling debt, loss of American lives, or pulling resources from pressing domestic issues. Washington abstained from forging international alliances and wisely avoided involvement in the destructive French Revolution, despite many within the U.S. encouraging to do otherwise. Moreover, despite having plenty of opportunities to seize absolute power, Washington resisted this temptation, voluntarily stepping down from the presidency after serving two terms. He could have easily remained in office for life, given his immense popularity and the absence of term limits at the time. Similarly, he could have expanded executive authority to override Congress and establish himself as an authoritarian leader. Nevertheless, Washington opted for humility, recognizing that what the United States urgently needed was a stable democratic republic, not an autocratic regime. As a result, the legacy that George Washington left behind led the country, which still stands today. His military prowess is what defeated the British and secured American independence, while his political awareness, humility, and upstanding moral character are what set the precedent that every subsequent American president has tried to match. A legacy which is fit for any monument. A cultural necessity that any national identity requires to rally the population behind is a hero, and the United States was struggling to forge her independence. The military leadership of George Washington is what kept the dream alive, meaning that he was immortalized as a hero before the war was even won. As a result, there were continual plans to build a monument in Washington's name going back as far as 1783. Initially, there were plans to build a statue of George Washington riding a horse, which were eventually turned into smaller statues in Washington, D.C., many years later. Then, when Washington passed away in 1799, there were also plans to build a grand tomb, with a crypt sepulcher inside the Capitol building underneath the dome. But architectural disagreements, along with the Washington family's refusal to move his remains from his native Virginia, saw these plans scrapped. But beyond that, there were developments for plans of a massive monument in Washington's honor, which would be located in D.C. But the political climate of the time got in the way. Despite Washington being the hero of the Revolution, he soon began to be associated with the Federalist Party, an ideology which was attacked by the Democratic Republican Thomas Jefferson during the election of 1800, an election which Jefferson would win, ushering in a wave of republicanism. Along with the Democratic Republican anti-elitism views, coinciding with the rise of the Baptist domination across the American South, it was also seen as undemocratic and authoritarian to build monuments honoring powerful leaders. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be until several decades after in which the political landscape would evolve to the point where Washington was then seen again as a figure that all Americans can universally uphold. It was at this time where the plans to build a monument for George Washington were renewed. In 1833, the Washington National Monument Society was formed, a group of many wealthy citizens looking to finally build an awe-inspiring monument in the Capitol in honor of the first president. This organization includes many prominent individuals, such as the wives of Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Adams, among several others. Amidst rising donations, they also held a contest to choose the best design. Eventually, an architect named Robert Mills won. This was also significant because Mills was the first native-born American to be trained as an architect, and he even previously designed one of the smaller aforementioned Washington monuments in Baltimore. Mills' plans for this new monument were seen as incredibly ambitious, audacious, and unique, with some in the Washington National Monument Society calling it, quote, unparalleled in the world. The design involved a 600-foot-tall, ancient Egyptian-style obelisk, or four-sided narrow pyramid-like structure, which were used to honor the dead. Surrounding the obelisk would be a ring of 30 100-foot-tall columns inspired by classical Greek architectural styles. The colonnade would then house statues of other American heroes from the Revolutionary War, with an extravagant statue of George Washington riding a chariot on top. Back in 1791, when the city of Washington, D.C. was designed, the French-American military engineer, Peter Lanfranc, had actually dedicated an open space which he intended to be used for a monument to George Washington. This is where Mills planned to put the monument, but due to the expected weight of the entire complex, it had to be moved slightly southwest. While many reveled in the impressive nature of the design, there were large concerns over the necessary funds to make Mills' vision a reality. Well, there were continual issues collecting enough money, a sufficient amount was procured, and construction began in 1848. After the site was excavated, the first cornerstone was officially laid down on July the 4th, and a wondrous ceremony was held. Interestingly enough, nearly 20,000 people attended the ceremony, including President James K. Polk, the aforementioned First Ladies, who were all members of the Washington National Monument Society, and even three of the next four future presidents, James Buchanan, Abraham Lincoln, and Andrew Johnson. Starting from the building ceremony, construction was underway with the foundation being laid down first. This began with the Blue Gneiss Fountain forming an 80-foot square step pyramid. After completing the substructure, builders moved on to the above-ground marble portion, which had a base measuring 55 feet by 1.5 inches square. They employed a combination of pulleys, block and tackle systems, and a mounted derrick to lift and position the stones, gradually elevating the structure. In the initial phase, only a few stones required skilled stonemasons, those being the marble blocks on the outer surface and the gneiss stones forming the rough inner walls, with other inner structures left jagged. The majority of stones used in this phase, varying from large to small, formed a rubble pile held together by mortar between the outer and inner walls. The foundation beneath the walls consisted of layered gneiss rubble, lacking the massive stones within the walls. Most of the stones in the first phase came from the quarries in the upper Potomac River Valley. Cockeysville marble was predominantly used, sourced from quarries north of downtown Baltimore and rural Baltimore County, similar to the stones used in the first Washington Monument by Mills. Construction continued for 6 years, until by 1854, the monument had ascended to a height of 156 feet above ground level. However, it was in 1854 when the Washington National Monument Society effectively ran out of money, as their failure to secure more donations eventually caught up with them. To make matters worse, the architect, Robert Mills, died the next year. Also, in 1854, Pope Pius IX donated a memorial stone to the Washington Monument, which was then referred to as the Pope's Stone. This elicited a strong reaction from the Know Nothing Party, a prominent political party and movement in the U.S. at the time, which was seriously anti-Catholic. Members of the Know Nothing Party were able to take control over the Washington National Monument Society, though many original members rejected the new reign, forming a separate society which clashed with the Know Nothings over the monument's construction and administration. Due to the infighting as well as the general lack of funds, little progress was made and only 4 feet were added onto the monument by 1859. Eventually, the Know Nothing Party, as a political entity itself, began to fracture and fall apart due to their own internal disagreements. And as a result, their control over the Washington Monument also fell, thrusting the original society back in charge, this time with the funding of Congress. Unfortunately, this did not lead to construction picking up where it left off, though, as in 1861, the Civil War would commence, and all federal funding went to the war effort, and later, reconstruction projects in the aftermath. After nearly 2 decades of the unfinished Washington Monument laying dormant, interest to complete it came in 1876, coinciding with the huge nationwide celebrations of the 100th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The discussions over what the monument should look like were also reopened, although Robert Mills comically said before his passing that leaving out the colonnade would make the monument resemble, quote, a stalk of asparagus. A lone obelisk was much more accurate to its ancient Egyptian inspiration, and this was preferred in order to cut cost to make the construction easier. Then, in 1879, construction officially resumed, now being overseen by the United States Army Corps of Engineers, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Lincoln Casey. After repairing the foundation, more stones were added to the obelisk, but this presented a new challenge. You see, 20 years earlier, the quarry from Baltimore was used as a source of stone, but since it had been so long, that quarry was now closed. A new quarry in Massachusetts was used, but unfortunately, the stone was of a visibly different color and texture. Having limited options, Colonel Casey stuck with the stone from Massachusetts, and to this day, you can see at which point the type of stone was switched by looking at the color difference. In order to complete the structure, the construction workers utilized a steam-powered elevator capable of hoisting 6 tons of stone to a mobile 20-foot-tall iron frame. The masons proceeded incrementally up the monument, constructing 20 feet of stone and mortar before relocating the iron framework by 20 feet, repeating this process as they ascended. At the height of 470 feet above the ground, builders initiated the inward angling of buttresses to support the 300-ton marble pyramidion atop the monument. These buttresses provided stability for the angled walls of the pyramidion, anchored by mortise and tenon joints, which began their inward ascent at 500 feet above ground level. Since the beginning of construction in 1848, many memorial stones had been donated, but one of the interesting things Colonel Casey did was restructure the interior so that all the memorial stones were positioned in the interior walls so they were much easier to see from the inside. But we'll talk more about the memorial stones shortly. Then, by 1884, the 3,300-pound capstone was placed on top with a small aluminum tip at the apex. Upon this aluminum tip is an inscription in Latin, translating to "Praise be to God." The monument was nearly finished. All it needed was the infrastructure to make it accessible to the public. Then, in 1885, the Washington Monument was officially dedicated during a big ceremony featuring speeches from many government officials, including U.S. President Chester A. Arthur. Standing at 555 feet tall, the Washington Monument was briefly the tallest building in the world, surpassing the Cologne Cathedral in Cologne, Germany. And though the Eiffel Tower would eclipse the Washington Monument in 1889, it still remains the tallest building in Washington, D.C. to this day. Well, it would take a year for the monument to be opened to the public. The construction project had finally been completed, and the nation's capital had a monument to honor George Washington at last. The Washington Monument is one of the most recognizable American landmarks, both for its immense height, but also for the man it honors. Anyone who travels to Washington, D.C. can easily see it from all across the city, but what most don't know is that after being built, the monument has had a deeply interesting and peculiar history, intertwined with hidden architectural features, later renovations, earthquakes, and even, unfortunately, terrorist attacks. So let's cover the basics of this history. Built into the surrounding area, or even within the walls of the monument's interior itself, are several features with interesting history in their own regard. One example of this are the memorial stones, which we briefly mentioned earlier. Throughout the duration of the monument's construction, many U.S. states, cities, foreign nations, organizations, clubs, societies, schools, universities, businesses, churches, and unions donated a stone to be used to help to build the structure. These stones would have the donor's name inscribed on them and are placed throughout the interior of the structure so that visitors can see who contributed to the construction of the monument. There is some disagreement over the total amount, as some opinions differ over what can officially be considered a memorial stone, but estimates range between 150 and 200. The most famous stone is most likely that aforementioned Pope's stone sent by Pope Pius IX in 1854. On this stone was the Latin inscription, meaning Rome to America. Unfortunately, this stone was destroyed and dumped into the Potomac River by the anti-Catholic Know Nothing Party before it could be placed in the wall. However, a replacement stone was sent by John Paul II in 1982. There are several other notable peculiar stones. For example, the largest stone donated to the Washington Monument was actually sent by the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire in a gesture to improve relationships. The stone was inscribed in Turkish by one of the most famous calligraphers of the time. Another stone was donated by the Roku Kingdom, a Pacific sovereignty under the dominion of Japan. The stone was actually transported to the United States by the famous American naval officer, Commodore Matthew C. Perry. As time went on, newer technological additions were necessary to make the viewing experience much easier for tourists. For example, in 1901, the obelisk steam-driven elevator, which would take nearly 10 to 12 minutes to rise the entire tower, was replaced with a much more efficient electric elevator. This was also necessitated by the increasing number of tourists arriving every year. It was estimated that attendance peaked in the late 1970s, with nearly 1.1 million visitors every year. So much so that in the last decade, restrictions were placed on how many people can visit, with most tickets being sold online for pre-order. From 1998 to 2001, the entire monument also undertook a massive restoration project meant to repair and strengthen the stone, much of which had been placed over 150 years prior. A comparably big construction job occurred in the early 2010s, after nearby Virginia was rocked by a 5.8 magnitude earthquake in August of 2011. While the monument stayed standing, of course, the earthquake still did considerable damage, with over 150 cracked openings across the entire complex. Furthermore, a block in the top pyramidion was dislodged, and debris of small stones came cascading down to the base of the monument. Restoration commenced immediately, but this was made even more complicated once Hurricane Irene hit the East Coast later that month, causing water damage as well. As a result, the Washington Monument would remain closed until 2014. But following this successful operation, it has been open for tourism ever since. Aside from natural disasters, the Washington Monument also had extra work done in between 2001 and 2011, but this was in response to the tragic events of the September 11th attacks, where other American landmarks were targeted. In case of another traumatic event like that, extra interior support was given to make sure the entire complex does not fall in the event of an explosion. And as long as we're on the topic of terrible events, I should point out that the site was actually attacked in December of 1982. It all started when a nuclear disarmament activist named Norman Mayer painted the phrase, "Number one priority, ban nuclear weapons," on a white van and parked it at the base of the monument, claiming that the van was filled with 1,000 pounds of TNT. Mayer then held 8 tourists hostage inside the monument, threatening to detonate the explosives and destroy the Washington Monument unless there was a substantial national conversation regarding the menace posed by nuclear weapons. Nearby, buildings were evacuated, and the police attempted to negotiate with Mayer during a 10-hour standoff. Unfortunately, these peace talks failed, and Mayer attempted to drive off in the van. Fearing an even worse outcome, U.S. Park Police snipers opened fire on Mayer's van, killing him in the process. After some investigation, it turned out that there were no explosives in the van. But thanks to the heroic measures taken by the police, none of the hostages were harmed. When walking through Washington, D.C., one of the most iconic and easy-to-spot landmarks is undoubtedly the Washington Monument, the tall stone obelisk that towers over our nation's capital. But by looking into this one singular structure, we can open many stories of history. Stories of great technological and architectural wonders, the political landscape at different times in the nation's history, hidden features, natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes, tragic events, and of course, the story of George Washington himself, the father of the United States of America. And we'll leave it there for today. Thank you all so much for watching, and until next time, this is Ryan Sokash, signing off.